Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 241. And today's episode is a bonus, for starters. I'm giving you Christmas presents early. And I'm joined by Matt Palmer, who's a writer and director. And it was one of the most natural conversations I've had. We hit it off. It's so insightful. It's insightful for me. Like, to hear someone speaking about the independent film industry and making films happen and making them work. And we have a chat about the relationship between director and DOP. And we use Ben Wheatley and Laurie Rose as an example of these great people who, when they get together, they make this absolute magic. So it's a great episode. I think you're going to enjoy it. I need to plug things. I've mentioned numerous times. I'll probably stop plugging it after this, but I did a BBC Lifeline appeal for the British Stammering Association, and it means a lot to me. So it'd be cool if you could give that a watch. It's on iPlayer, easy to find. And it's an interesting one. It's a weird thing being a dude with a stutter in all of these different industries where I use my voice, podcasting in particular. Acting is the interesting one, because it'd be really interesting to get a character who has a stutter. It was weird doing the Lifeline appeal, because in general, there's a stutter. In general, I spend my whole life holding down my stutter to varying successes. But in this, it was kind of like, well, if you stutter a little bit, it's good. It gets the message across more. So it was really weird. I didn't want to fake stutter anything. We did a lot of different takes. So some had stutters in and some didn't. It's weird. Anyway, Christmas is coming, guys, and over at speechdevelopmentrecords.com, I've got loads of signed stuff, and a signed gift is a great Christmas gift. For example, my Distraction Pieces podcast book. If you're listening to this, and if you heard about it because your mate listens to it or your partner listens to it, then that's a solid idea for a Christmas gift, right? A signed Distraction Pieces podcast book, you know? Come on, that's great. And I don't charge any extra for it being signed. They're signed in the web store. I've also got signed copies of my graphic novel of poems. That should appeal. And I've got tons of winter stuff. I've got scarves. I've got hats. I've got a new bit of merch coming that I almost said out loud, but I don't want to tell you about yet. I'll tell the secret Patreon gang first, patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. And then I'll tell the rest of you, and you'll all be very excited because it's so dope. I've ordered them. I've gone back and forth for over 2 months on design, and we've finally sent them off to be made, and I can't wait to see them and then to shoot in them and then to sell them to you guys, put them out into the world. Anyway, we've got umbrellas on the website. We've got everything. speechdevelopmentrecords.com. I'll shut up now because this is a bonus, so you've got an extra one anyway. You've got enough to listen to this week. You're going to enjoy this, and then if you haven't watched it already, I recommend you jumping on Netflix and watching Calibre. I mean, this is coming out on a Friday. What better wintry Friday night film? It's a bit creepy, a bit scary, but it's wonderful, and it's rightfully winning a lot of awards and a lot of plaudits. So I was really pleased to get to chat to Matt Palmer, and it was hooked up by my man Aaron Shrimpton, who's worked on tons of my music videos over the years. So big love and shout out to him for hooking that up. New Waverley Studios, I think I've got that right. Big love there, and enjoy the episode. I'll be back at the end to just do the bits that you do at the end of a podcast. You know, it'd be weird if the conversation just ended and then the podcast ended. It seems like it's the social norm for me to come on at the end, repeat half the stuff I've said in this intro, and then be all like, oh, like and subscribe and stuff like that. So that's what's going to happen. Don't act as if it's not expected. You have contributed to the society where that is the norm. So that's what's going to happen. Anyway, this is episode 241 of the Distraction Pieces podcast, a bonus episode with Mr. Matt Palmer. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece
is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
Right, I'm joined today by Matt Palmer. How are you, sir?
I'm very good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad we kind of got this locked down, because we're going to be talking a lot about your debut film, Calibre, which is going crazy. But the really pleasing part for me is we started emailing to line this up before it started to get all these award nominations and become like one of the most hyped kind of independent type films of the year. So I feel a level of credibility that I'm not just jumping on the hype train.
You were there at the start.
I was there excited because, yeah. A mutual friend of ours, Aaron Shrimpton, put us in touch, and literally the day he mentioned it and kind of said, oh, I know the director. And me and my girlfriend slung it on Netflix and absolutely adored it. It's in my... I've got on my phone, on my notes next to my podcast notes, mm-hmm. which are here. I make a note of every film I see each year, and I put a star by the ones that are in the running to be my films of the year. And Calibre currently has a star by it, so you'll be. I'm not promising. It's a good year for films, but So how's it been having that excitement?
It's been amazing, you know, and it's to some extent it's. It's more exciting because in the back end of last year, like we finished the film in June 2017.
Yeah.
And then there was a period where we weren't getting into film festivals.
Yeah.
So as I guess any director would do, if you give them enough rope, they'll basically hang themselves. So I thought, I'm not sure the film works. I don't know why we're not getting into film festivals. So I kind of had already gone to a point where I'd kind of accepted that maybe... It's not very good.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, then things started pulling back. And I think it turned out in the end that we didn't get into the film festivals because it's a genre movie, it's a thriller, but it's also kind of a bit more serious. And I think the film festivals were a bit confused by that. And then sort of the back end of last year, about November, things suddenly turned and people started saying they liked it. And then it came on Netflix and people started watching it. So, it's really... really fucking exciting, but it's doubly exciting because I was at that low point where I thought this isn't,
and again it's such a weird thing with any art that you're invested in, which particularly as your debut film you're going to have been thinking about this for a long time and been, you get so close to it that you can't tell if it's good. And my limited acting experience, I've done two films, or I've done three and I got edited out of one, but these things happen. But the two films I've done, it was exactly that. I watched them, I was like, I think this is really good, but also it's people I love in it and people I'm excited, I'm glad, I've been on a journey with, so I'm excited because of that. I don't know if I can be analytical on that.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I did, worked on a lot of, I made three short films, but also worked on a lot of short films because I used to do sound recording and sound post. And the thing is, a thing happened with every short film I ever worked on is at the end of it, at the wrap party, you'd get drunk with all the new friends you'd made. And every single time I'd be like, this is the fucking one.
Yeah.
Like, this is, I can feel it. This is going to be amazing, And then the thing is, to varying degrees, they are great, or sometimes they're not great. And so by the time it came to making Calibre, and finishing it, I definitely got to that point where I was very aware of my own inability to actually know whether it was any good.
Yeah.
But there's, of course, like with your first feature, there's so much riding on it, because if it doesn't work, then you really, it's going to be that much more difficult to get a second one
completely
up and running. So
you're potentially at the back of the queue again. In many ways, it's worse, or in a worse position than you were originally, because when you're an unknown quantity, it's like, I've got this idea.
For sure.
If you're a known quantity, like, oh, look, that didn't really work.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird one. It's such an odd one.
Mm. But I was very, I was very worried about, is it... And ultimately, because so many people came to the project and put so much into it, countless collaborators, the actors and the DOP and so many people just chucking, it's cold, you could probably tell from the film, we're in the middle of the woods in...
I was going to ask about this. It's all shot in the Highlands essentially, and
well, it's no, that's quite a big cheap, because the thing is, nothing, no location in the film, apart from some of the sort of the landscapes and sort of GVs. That's, you know, we went up to the Highlands and we shot stuff up there. But in terms of the primary locations, there's three of them, and none of them are, the furthest one away is like an hour and 10 minutes from Edinburgh. The, the woods are actually 45 minutes from Glasgow, 45 minutes from Edinburgh.
Yeah.
It's just that it turned out that there were, thankfully for us, locations within touching distance of Edinburgh that actually seemed more Highlands than the Highlands, because we did scout the whole Highlands.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. Initially, I thought, you know, we'll just... I think you always like want everything to be a bit gonzo, and you're like, we'll just get in the car. Because they did that with the original Wicker Man.
Yeah.
What they did, they must have had more money. They basically went down the coast of Scotland and just hand-picked. And, you know, when you watch the Wicker Man, it feels like you're in a totally coherent place, but actually... Almost every, they had like something like 37 locations, and so they just travelled down the country picking all of Robin Hardy's favourite locations.
It's got to be looking at, or looking at it in a non-romantic way has to be key, right? Because the fact is, proximity to everything else is important. If you need anything, if you're short of anything, if anything's gone wrong for actors, for everyone else, that all helps. But equally, you realise as soon as you start making these things, how much room there is on the other side of the camera as such. It's the exact, like, instantly as you were saying that, and I'm not trying to turn this on to being a this is your life of my brief film career, but the first thing I ever did was this, the Guy Ritchie film King Arthur, and I got edited out of it. I wasn't in it, but I always remember having a day on set where I'd been there as a film nerd, just blown away, because it's this huge Fox film, the sets are amazing. And then there was one moment where I was in a scene that I didn't have any lines, but because of where I was positioned, I could kind of just see what the camera sees. And it blew me away, because all this time I've been like, oh, these sets are amazing, and then at that angle I was like, no, I'm in Camelot. I mean, you know, it's that beautiful thing of, I've been here going, I'd not been losing myself in it in the way I should have. And it's that a big realisation that because you're walking around the sets, you can see everything that's on the other side of the camera. But that small bit that's in front of the camera is its own world, like when you realise on the screen. And it's a similar thing there. If you can find the right locations that are right in that square that you're filming them in.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like I sometimes wonder with, you know, like some of the current Hollywood stuff where people are essentially in a warehouse wearing like those suits on green screen all day. It's like, it's kind of interesting. It's very clever that the actors can do that. But like, I would always, up to this point at least, ideally always go to, you know, being out in the woods and, you know, being in a real farm, you know, that which was mucky, you know, I sometimes feel like it's helpful to the actors because it's easier 100%. For them to, you know,
it's easier to lose yourself in it, right?
Yeah.
And for makeup and everyone, because if you've got genuinely ruddy cheeks and whatever, because it's cold, it's like that translates. You can fake that, but you can't fake that.
I guess it's like you can see their breath. You can see that it's freezing. Do you know what I mean? And there's actually like the set in the woods where the main kind of action happens, like the main sort of act, the tragedy in the film, and then it comes back later in the film for a kind of sort of a climactic bit in the woods. Like, it was literally like when we started in that clearing, it was grass. And by the time we'd done our 3 days of shooting, it was a mud pit. And if you look, it's funny because I guess, you know, you're saying like it's hard to be objective when you finish the film. Like in the edit, I was like, God, people are just going to be able to see that the actors are literally all look like they're about to fall over because they look like they're ice skating on mud.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But the thing is, now I don't even notice that. And that's the thing that's tricky is, you get to a point in the edit where you start going mad and all you can see is the details and the joins. You know what I mean? And that's the weird thing about making a film is you're never going to see it with the same eyes as, like, anybody else.
It's an interesting thing that we'll discuss later on, maybe, is that what you've said right there is one of the reasons I love and fear for the life of the cinema. Because I think in the cinema you do absorb into a film in a different way to on Netflix. And this is obviously, I watched this on Netflix, I watched it at home, I had the lights off, I was absorbed in it. But still, you're always going to have that slight looking around the room or again, if you're scum looking at your phone, you should be focusing. I'm sorry, it's unacceptable. But, you know, it is a weird thing that films are changing and cinema is changing. And I think just weirdly from doing music videos, which again is where I met Aaron, which is our link here, that made me pay more attention to films than ever before. Because I was aware that in this little 3-minute thing, we've slaved over if we're going to, how much of a cross dissolve we're going to have. And these tiny little details that, not that you should be watching a film and overanalyzing everything, but you should be paying respect to the fact that someone has slaved over every, like the things that have probably plagued your mind in the edit and are irrelevant now. It's that still, that effort and passion has gone into that.
It's true, but it's a really difficult one because at the same time, you know, if somebody's made a movie and you don't like it, then it's really, you know, if somebody watches Caliber and they don't like it, I can't expect them to go, oh, you know, I'm going to sit and I'm going to try and find the best in it.
It's like,
you know, we were talking about this earlier before we started. To some extent, if you create stuff and you put it out there, you just have to have, it's going to be for some people and it's not going to be for others. Do you know what I mean?
The slogan of my record label on the bag beside me here is "We may not be for you, and that's fine."
Yeah.
And again, that's the outlook to approach a lot of art, particularly as we're in a world now where, because we've got so much access to reach everyone, it's easy to forget that most art isn't for everyone. Most comedy isn't for everyone. Most film isn't for everyone.
It can't be for everyone. Yeah. I think to some extent the problems, a big problem comes up when you get the sense that, like, particularly with studios, because I think it's weird with the Netflix thing, because for me the biggest problem at the moment is the studios, because the studios have gone so conservative. When you find out that, like, there's kind of a seismic moment when one of the studios decided that Martin Scorsese's new film with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino was too much of a risk.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if Scorsese's after Wolf of Wall Street is too much of a risk, then what exactly is going on here?
And with De Niro and Pacino and Pesci and Harvey Keitel and Stephen Graham and just an endless list of amazing people telling the story that he'd always wanted to tell with Goodfellas and all that, but didn't have the rights to, yet that's a bit of a risk. Weird.
Yeah, and I think that's, I think that's a massive problem.
It's a weird one for me because I'm undecided. As much as I love the cinema, I am also aware that because of the boom of TV, making films is fucking hard. Mm. Getting films signed off on or people up for making them is really tough. And Netflix and Amazon and things like that are keeping that alive a little bit. It's not having to be a, well, is it going to compete with Avengers?
Yeah.
If not, let's not make it. The importance of independent and small films and artistic films, in a way, as much as I'd love to see them all in the cinema, in a way some of them wouldn't exist if we didn't have people like Netflix who are willing to
take a chance on these things. It's a complete... I think to some extent it almost feels like Netflix is going to self-right the problems that the studios have run into, because there's so many superhero movies. So now it's just like, we're only going to make superhero movies. So we're going to squeeze out all these other movies, but I just feel like there's always going to be a massive audience for, like, more adult, not adult movies.
but grown-up.
Yeah, grown-up movies, you know, and I think that what will happen ultimately is Netflix will start, they're going to take all the big directors across and they're going to make films that will be successful. And I think Netflix will probably then start moving into the cinemas, and essentially what will happen is it will just de-evolve. Or re-evolve out of the superhero fixation that...
Yeah.
I mean, I've got no problem with superhero movies, but there's just so fucking many of them. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, that's just not a... And that, I think, has as much to do with the studios just being scared shitless and making anything.
Yeah.
That they can be increasingly paranoid about, to the extent now that it's almost like anything that's not a superhero movie is a risk, which is just a situation that where
and again,
things are kind of untenable.
It's thing that's sad, because I guess it's because of how much money is involved in it, but studios and producers should be taking risks. Again, I've moaned about it before, but I genuinely think that America's system of pilot season is partly to blame for a lot of this, because rather than a producer going, I believe in this, let's make it, they're going, let's make one episode and see if people like it. So, well, most good things you shouldn't be able to tell in the first episode. It shouldn't be giving you everything in one go and begging you to keep watching and like it. It should be able to slowly build and develop naturally.
No, for sure. And there's quite a lot of those huge. I remember like The Wire and Mad Men and like Ray Donovan and, you know, True Detective was fucking amazing from the first image.
Yeah, yeah.
But like with a lot of those ones, it's just like, I remember, you know, it taking 5 or 6 episodes. I was like, I don't know if I like this. And then suddenly like, okay, I get it. I love it. But
The Wire, I stopped halfway through the first episode to make sure I put the right disc of the DVD in. Because I was like, is this the first episode? Because it feels like I've come in halfway through a season. Because it's that kind of just slow and natural. And
but did he? I think David Simon described the first season of The Wire as basic training.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I remember actually it did do... It was The Wire was kind of like it did rewire my brain because I was like, if I don't concentrate on every single line that's being said here, I cannot follow this. And to start with, that feels like a massively like a chore and like, oh God, can I really be bothered with another one? But once you get up to speed on it, you start. That's an amazing that level of focus. That's why people meditate. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so completely.
Whereas I think a lot of like modern culture at the moment is pushing the other way, and it's kind of like the it's almost like what people think they want is they think they want to go to the cinema and not have to think.
Yeah.
But the thing is that ultimately not thinking is not pleasant.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I agree.
Like it's
I agree.
But that's why I like The Wire, and I just think there should be more.
It's a big saying and a belief that films and TV are an escape from reality, and I don't believe that. I don't subscribe to that. They enhance my reality. They improve my reality. It's not an escape for me. It's not a switch off.
Mm-hmm.
It's that I want my mind to do things it wouldn't have done in my day-to-day life. I want to take it to places and have emotions and have feelings and even just see things. Again, as much as I talk about the negative impact potentially of the superhero movies, I'm not against them. I love superhero movies. I love going and experiencing that on a big screen and go, wow, that's mind-blowing. But that's not all I want.
That's
where the problem comes up, is they go, all right, well, that one works, so let's only do that.
Yeah. And you do get a weird thing with superhero movies too, where they'll say like, oh, but this is a new kind of superhero movie where it's almost not like a superhero movie. It's like, well, just make a movie that isn't a superhero movie instead of trying to make one that's so unlike a superhero movie. That, you know what I mean?
It's a
strange thing. But
So what was your route into film? Like, where did you grow up? And was cinema always, you know, a love of yours and a desire to do that? Or was it, you know, something you stumbled into, an unrealistic dream?
Yeah, I kind of, when I was at school, there was, I guess I was more into music really, but there was a friend I had who was like massively into the cinema and he was like a proto geek before like cinema geeks were. Now they're, you know,
everyone,
all of us. But he'd have like all the ticket stubs from the movies he'd seen over the past year, and he'd make like little sort of things that he'd hang in his room. So
amazing.
He'd cut like posters out and have them hanging from the ceiling.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And I just got kind of like totally into movies through him, and then he started, like, he bought this book called The Deep Red Horror Handbook, which was like a sort of book from the 80s, and it just had all these films in that I'd never heard of that sounded completely insane. And it's like, what are these movies? So I got massively into like horror movies and like video nasties, and that kind of through that I then started getting into kind of cult movies.
Yeah.
And the thing is that back then It was interesting, and it's one of the things that I think is a real shame is that TV's massively changed, because back then they would program all kinds of weird shit on TV. So you'd get the Radio Times and you'd go through the listings and you'd be like, look at this. At like 3 a.m. on Tuesday, there's some like black and white New York movie set on the subway that sounds really interesting. So you'd set your video recorder, and of course that was its own thing, because you set your video recorder and you're never quite sure whether the fucking thing will actually record it. So you get up in the morning, did it. Well, I had one thing happen where I copied Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
And this was at a time when I worked in like this terrible clothes shop in Kidderminster where I was brought up, and it was like in the year between like school and uni. And I think it was like 2 a.m. and I was like, really, I need, I've just watched a movie, I need to go to bed. I was like, no, I'm going to watch Taxi Driver. Never seen it. So I put Taxi Driver on, but But I'd recorded it on a 90-minute tape. And, of course, Taxi Driver is 95 minutes and has an amazing last 5 minutes. So it just stopped after 90 minutes at, like, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, man.
And, but that's the whole exciting world of, like, video cassettes and video recorders.
There was, I'm a big fan of mixed martial arts, and there was a big thing recently because Bellator, who are, like, the second biggest company, have just done a deal to show their fights live on Channel 5, and it was the first time it was happening a couple of weekends ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's live sports. Things overrun, they go either way.
Yeah.
It got to the main event. I believe it just started, and then Peppa Pig started on Channel 5 because it was 6 a.m., and that's when Peppa Pig starts. So all these fight fans have stayed up till 6 a.m. to watch these fights, and suddenly they're watching an episode of Peppa Pig.
Oh no! I mean, Peppa Pig is
the same problem.
Peppa Pig is fantastic, but not when you want to watch a fight.
I mean, it might be the perfect thing to ease you off before you go to sleep after a long night of testosterone. Just ease into Peppa Pig. So you started to get into film then.
Mm.
It's interesting. I mean, discussing the problems with TV programming, it's a similar thing that I think your Netflixes are solving the problems of, because in film and TV, again, in getting it made these days, it feels like there's a, so what is it? Is it a drama? Is it a comedy? Mm-hmm. Is it this or is it that? And so many things are many things. And Calibre's an example of that, because it's a thriller, but it's more, it feels like a horror.
Mm.
It just happens to not have any monsters, mm-hmm. or anything a supernatural in it. And that's what's great about things like that is I do think, again, we're a year or two away from people realizing that genre, it's just pointless labels.
Mm.
We don't need it anymore. It's if it's good, it'll work. If it isn't, it won't. We don't need, because we've got such instant access to everything now, rather than saying, so what is it, you can go, oh, it's here, just have a look.
Well, I spoke to somebody like a couple of weeks ago who works in the industry in Scotland, and they said, because, you know, I made 3 shorts and all the short films were horrors.
Mm.
And they said, you know, you nailed your, like, colours to the mast fairly early on.
Yeah.
And I just thought, like, for me, like, you know, drama, genre, it's just good drama and bad drama.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And
yeah.
Ultimately, there's good stories and shit stories.
Completely.
And really, like, whether it's a genre movie or whether it's a drama, really is. I mean, I've always, like, I think making genre films in the UK has always been tough.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, like, Ben Wheatley basically just reinvented the wheel. By,
100%.
By kicking out all those films so quickly.
Yeah.
And them being successful. But really, like, Britain just doesn't really do genre cinema.
Oh, it's the tough thing, particularly with things like horrors or whatever, it will have seemed like a big deal to get a Fright Fest or whatever, but in reality it became, well, that's the only place now for horror. Oh, the festival is this month, here's the only place for it. It's like, well, no, there's still films. They still can have their place at any point. It's not, oh, no, we do that in October or we do that in September. It's like, no, it shouldn't be restricted into one area and one time scale.
Yeah, I think that's a shame. I mean, the horror angle, it's interesting that you say, like, that the, you know, it feels like it's the thing that's been massively useful in with Calibre is that it somehow, you know, it's definitely, I mean, to me it's definitely a thriller. It's,
yes,
it's not really a horror movie.
Yeah,
but the thing is, like you say, it's sort of weirdly is. So what's happened is that I think all of the horror fans feel like they, you know, there's a lot at the moment, a lot of them are doing this thing where they watch a movie every day for the whole of October, like 31 days of Halloween or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, already, like, I've seen about 5, 6, 7 where people are like, so watch Calibre as part of this, and then it'll be, it's not really a horror movie at all, but it's like, what's been great for us is it feels like the horror audience feel like they need to check in on it and have a look.
Yeah,
even though, do you know what I mean? So it's really a case of, like, having your cake and eating it.
Yeah,
because normally, in order to do that, you have to make a horror movie. But we've made a thriller and somehow managed to, like, just tap into that. But
to,
I guess,
to get the horror fans in there as well.
Yeah, which is totally cool. I mean, there's a flip side, which is, you know, some people get pissed off because they want it to be a horror movie and it's not really a horror movie. And,
yeah.
And, you know, some of the sort of references in there. I read a review the other day that said essentially this is like the oldest folk horror setup in the book.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's interesting because that's actually kind of true. But the, and, you know, some people, again, you know, Stephen King tweeted about the movie, yeah, which was just fucking huge for us. And
amazing, right?
But he referenced, yeah, it was, I mean, that was a...
It was a couple of days after I'd emailed you. So, it was exactly that. I was like, yes, I see, I'm not just reacting. It's clear I'm not just reacting. I'm already in.
But amazing, like, though. Yeah, it was great, but he referenced The Wicker Man. So you had this whole slew of, like, online reviews that were like, this isn't the fucking Wicker Man. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, no, but it was never, like, I didn't say it was The Wicker Man.
I didn't claim it was The Wicker Man.
But the thing that surprised me a little bit is I just, those sort of, I guess, you'd maybe call them nods, but essentially they're just those tropes of genre cinema that I just find massively satisfying.
Yeah.
So, like, the American Werewolf in London, like, going into the pub, or, like, the village where there's a kind of, I mean, essentially the reason that there's a kind of a festival in the village in the film.
Yeah.
It's a sort of, it's a point of focus just to make the guys conspicuous because they've, you know, they know this big thing's happening.
Yeah.
So why the hell would they be sitting drinking in their own hotel room?
Yeah.
It just makes them more conspicuous. But I think I was slightly taken aback by the extent to which quite a few people were like, once you referenced that, I wanted it to go full on Wicker Man. But it's like, surely after an hour of it being relatively realistic.
Yeah. Yeah.
You didn't then expect it to go all like kind of crazy cult because, do you know what I mean? I was quite surprised that people...
But again, it's great to have all those... It's great to have so much teasing of things there, of potential, oh, this may happen. And again, that's part of a thriller to kind of, is this going to happen? Are they going to get away with it? Are they going to get caught and this and that? Are they guilty? Are they not guilty as such? And all these different things. But then... You know, the rarity, and it nails it, is that it finishes and you're satisfied. It's not that kind of, oh, they've just teased us a load of stuff. The kind of Lost thing, where as soon as Lost got to its third or fourth series, people were like, I don't think anything can ever deliver on this now. They've built up so much. It's like, it's kind of feels impossible, unless they've got something huge up their sleeve, and then they're kind of like, turns out they didn't. Unless they've got something huge, then it could never, ever deliver. And I think that's what... Caliber does well is it, I don't know, it's an incredibly relatable and realistic situation, even though it's, I don't think anyone watching it will have been through that, you know, it's totally out there and crazy, but the way it's made and the way it's told, it makes it all the scarier because of how human it is and because of how you don't have that escape of, oh, it's fantastical, or there's a monster or whatever else. You've got your in it, and it's like, oh, this is uncomfortable. And
That's great to hear, and I guess that's what we were. It's funny because, you know, some of the reviews have been like, it's so realistic, and it's like, well, it's realistic apart from the fact that there's tracking shots.
Yeah,
you know, it's production designed within an inch of its life. There's music over the top. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But it's interesting. It's really helped with I think the Americans. It feels even more real to American audiences because they're used to a high level of gloss.
Yeah.
And actually, it's meant that it's hit quite hard, in the States, which has been super exciting. But the thing you said is interesting because, you know, one of the big coups with the film was getting Jack Loudon, because we had attached Jack Loudon to the film, and Jack was like a rising star. And he was probably the only Scottish actor, there's maybe two or three, but like the only Scottish actor who's going to become a movie star who fit the role. But then I'd had a chat with him, and he was kind of interested. But then he got cast in Dunkirk.
Right.
And so our casting director was like, well, that's it, isn't it? And I was like, is it? And she was like, yes, that's it. He's not going to do, like, Caliber after he's just done a Christopher Nolan film. And I was like, I don't know. I just think I have this feeling like Jack... Because the thing with Jack is Jack had won, like, the Olivier Award, so, like, the UK's biggest, like, theatre award.
Yeah.
At the age of, like, I think he won it at the age of, like, 19 or 21 or something. And when I met him, I could tell he's quite serious, kind of, he's very serious about his acting. He's a proper actor. He's not just, like, a pretty boy who wants to be a movie star.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just had this feeling that maybe, you know, because the script needs him to go to, some, you know, it needs some serious
it's a hell of fucking a role. Acting. Yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
I thought maybe we can just,
like,
hold on to him, which is what transpired. Which was amazing. But, you know, when we got on set and it came, actually, you know, the accident that happens in the film and the aftermath, which is one of the most intense scenes, was the third day of shooting.
Wow.
So it was super early, you know, and Jack just sort of turned around and he went, you know, you could sort of see the fear in his eyes because actors are very, as you'll know from doing it, they're very, the biggest fear is just of looking fucking stupid on screen.
And
so he basically said, you know, none of us have been through what happens to these guys. Like, this is a massively, like, this is just, nobody is bringing, like, normally, I guess, with acting, what you do is you bring your experience of the world and and your experience of similar situations into bear on the scene. And he was just like, none of us, like, me and Martin haven't got a, haven't got a fucking clue. Do you know, we're just jumping off a cliff here.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it's like, it's, you know, I mean, I can't act for shit, so the whole thing's mysterious to me anyway, but, like, that, you know.
How exciting was that early on to get that scene in the bag, knowing how big a push it is and how you're shooting it quite early to get that and go, all right, no, everyone's capable of this.
Yeah.
This is gonna work.
Well, it was my big fear before we did it. It was like, you know, if you write a script that is based on such a, centered around, hinged around something that is so massively serious. And then you can't cast it up to the standard you need to, so you end up with actors who are struggling with the material. This script and this film has the very real potential of being a travesty.
Yeah, it like becomes when people incredibly offensive.
Yeah, offensive and, like, cringeworthy and almost, worst of all, funny. Like, look what they were trying to do. Funny, but then kind of disgusting. So, I mean, casting those guys was just huge. And that day, there was one shot. Because the other thing is, like, we saw this this Hungarian DOP who, he shot Peter Strickland's first film, Katalin Varga, and that's how I'd seen that at the Edinburgh Film Festival. And, like, I was just like, this is exactly what I want caliber. Because this was, the script took about 6 years to develop. And this was very, just after the first draft, I was like, this is what I want it to look like. And, like, he's so great. But he's also extremely, like, one of the things he's super talented at is handheld stuff. He's just got this tendency where he just becomes the inquisitive eye of the viewer when he's doing handheld. Do you know what I mean? He just, the timing of the shit, like, he just instinctually knows what he should be looking at when, and when he should be moving from A to B. And so, and the aftermath of that, the accident that happens, there was one scene where Martin, I don't try not to do any spoilers, Martin has to physically move something or somebody across a clearing, which in its own right, I mean, Martin's, like, you know, was pulling a, it's going to be a bit of a spoiler, but pulling a 16 stone man across a clearing.
Yeah.
And Mark filmed it, and I was standing watching the monitor, and it was kind of a longer take. It was maybe about 50 seconds and just very, very physical. Mm. And the thing is, when I was looking at it, I just had this very strange moment where I felt like I was looking at something on YouTube because it looks so fucking real.
Amazing.
And that was when I was like, there's some real potential here if we can hit that kind of visceral, because it was properly like, you know. And the funny thing was, I immediately looked over, the first person I caught, whose eye I caught after that, was the focus puller. And he was just shaking his head at me. I was like, oh, he didn't like it. And he was like, totally fucking out of focus. And I was like, fuck off, you know. That doesn't matter. Like,
I mean, it's a beautiful thing to find someone who can bring that to a film, right, in the DOP, because, again, it's that...
It's a huge role.
Like. Yeah, it's awareness of how important that is in film, and it can be overlooked hugely. I was reading a book of notes from Bresson a while ago, and he was kind of saying how an early mistake of cinema is not realizing that it's not the theater. You're not meant to just sit back and film a play. You know, the beauty of true cinema is doing what you can't do in a play and doing what you can't do in other mediums, and that ability to put the viewer in the scene and, you know, have stuff that there's sounds going on off camera and the camera is turning to it and things like that. If you have someone who you as a director have that faith in to catch those moments, so it isn't, because again, in reality, it's not scripted and plotted out. We don't see everything in the traumatic or exciting or dangerous moments in our lives. We're we're doing it on the fly. Mm. We're catching up. And if you can have a DOP who you've got the faith in to go, look, just go in there and be part of it and allow the viewer to be part of it without inserting a POV or whatever, you know, having that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a massively important role because the thing is, the DOP has the potential to either kind of, I mean, the great thing with Mark is like, but immediately, like, so I got him over to make a short film with me.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those times when it felt like sort of I'd met a new, really close friend. There's that kind of eerie, like it feels like we've known each other for centuries.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just immediate connection.
Yeah.
Like we just agreed on, we don't agree on everything because the discussions and the kind of toing and froing on stuff is where you get to the correct ones, but just a general set of, you know, everything from like loving, you know, 35mm film grain to like, you know, giving the actors, like prioritizing the actors' performances, like just a list of like 50 things that we fundamentally agreed on. And the thing is that a DOP role is a role that a lot of men do it.
Yeah.
And it's a role that can be massively problematic on set because if you end up with a very male, male DOP
mm-hmm.
who's there to show you and show everybody else how great he is at being a DOP.
100%.
Not only does it cause a problem because they're not actually like linked to the material properly, they're just
trying to show off.
Trying to show off and make a new show
flex.
Reel.
Yeah, look how good I am.
But also it creates this very obnoxious sort of the director and the DOP and the producers tend to set the temper of the set. So if you end up with a DOP who's just kind of quite an obnoxious presence, it just makes the set, it makes it impossible to nurture that kind of openness.
Yeah,
you know,
completely.
And confidence in everyone's, because the other thing is they'll often like, you know, there's lots of great DOPs, I don't make it sound, but if you get a bad apple, they'll be mean to the art department, they'll be snidey about the actors, and do you know what I mean, and what you need is for everyone to be working together,
no one to be trying to make it their thing, everyone to make it our thing, right?
And I think that includes, and it's a tough one because obviously the entire nature of directing is to some extent is obviously going to attract obsessives. But I think that includes the director. I think sometimes the director has to get out of the fucking way of the movie.
There's Ray Akavan on recently who has got a series called The Bisexual, who did the Education of Cameron Post, which is out at the moment, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And talking to her, she was saying that she felt almost, it took her a while to get comfy with the guilt that she felt of putting trust in her team, you know, of feeling, I'm the director, but a lot of it, I'm just letting them do their thing because they're amazing at what they do. And it's like realizing that that's part of the role. That's part of your job to not be, I need to make sure everyone knows that this is me doing this. It's like, no, if you cast your team well, then a lot of it is that. A lot of it, you can step back and go, just make it happen.
It's very much like, I think it's very much like football management. It's like, do you know what I mean? You're essentially putting a team together. If you put the team together well enough, they'll win 5-0.
Yeah.
But there was definitely a moment, like on a couple of moments on set where I looked at what was unfolding in front of me and I stood there and thought, people are going to say, I did this. And that's when, you know, that's when I knew things were going well because I just thought, you know, this is just like
it's you
stand back and it's kind of weird because it's very hard to stand there and feel like you're not needed.
Yeah.
But if you can do that, then you know, because the inclination sometimes is to like wade in and just do something to remind people that I'm still here. This is all me. Do you know what I mean? It's like
again, it's about finding those relationships that you can all agree that no one needs to do that. And that must have been exciting to find a DOP that you connect with in that way. We've mentioned Ben Wheatley and his work with Laurie Rose as DOP. It's just, it's amazing because it feels like they've got that synergy. They've got that, they're just a team. And I'm as excited about Laurie Rose being a DOP on something as I am about Ben Wheatley being the director on something. And knowing those kind of things are key that, you know, they work together in the right way.
I think you can feel it. I mean, there's that, you know, Yann Demarge, Is it Jan DeMarge or Jan DeMarge? I think it's Jan DeMarge. Yeah. You know, the 71 guy.
I
mispronounced his name. But he's like got a DOP called Tat. Someone, this is a very bad story because I can't remember. But basically, again, those, you can just feel.
Yeah.
You know, you feel like there's a director. Because the thing is, like, the other thing is, as a director, you can, you know, you get a lot of credit for, people watch Calibre and think like, oh, look at all the crazy visual, you know, like, what a great place to put the camera. But it's like, that's not how it works on set. Because if you hire somebody whose entire, like, skill set is being a kind of visual genius, then, you know, if Mark comes up to me and goes, well, I was thinking was maybe this, and he understands the script and he's like, he's actually, you know, properly connected with the material, the chances are, as an incredibly astute visual person, he's gonna have a fucking great idea. So do you know what I mean? Like, and then the hardest thing sometimes is that you then start to think, well, I sort of don't need to do that, and then suddenly you'll go, hang on a minute, we need another angle here, and your job is to kind of get out of the way until, but at the same time, get out of the way but not shut down.
Yeah.
Because there is a tendency when everyone around you is doing great stuff is just to kind of shut down, whereas you have to sort of just keep monitoring and then go, hang on a minute, there's one thing over there.
Yeah, and being aware that in 6 months you're still going to be there working on this and the DOP will probably be off working on their next thing.
Yeah,
so it's knowing that you need to make sure you've got everything that you need and everything that they might not be able to see because of not being in the editing mind and things like that.
It's just kind of, I guess it's kind of like, it's weird, it's kind of like hovering above it all and watching it all and just making minor adjustments.
I think it's all of that that makes people believe that there's, you know, a nepotism in the film industry, or it's a who you know rather than what you know. And I think it's not that. I think it's that if there are people that you work with well and get on with, and you know that they're people that you're going to be comfortable spending 6 months of your life with, then you will try and keep working with them. That isn't a kind of excluding anyone else or being a boys' gang or a girls' gang or whatever else is going, no, here's someone I respect artistically and can work with.
I think when I was younger, I could not understand why people would work with the same teams.
Yeah.
I was just like, why would you not want to work with a new person?
And so mix it up, yeah.
And mix it up. But the thing is, it doesn't feel like that at all when you get older and when you've worked with people you trust. It just feels like you want to bring that same hive mind to the next project.
And the new idea is the new thing. It's not, you need no people to it. It was, oh, I've got this new, it's a new project.
Exactly. And it's like, what would, you know, what would Mark's mind, or what would Mirren's mind, or what would Ben, the sound, because the sound design was huge, and like Ben Baird's sound design was, it's like, what would Ben do with this?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So you just, I totally now understand what I didn't make any sense to me.
How was that coming from sound yourself?
Tough for Ben.
To then
annoying, really annoying.
Oh, right, here's
Ben.
Someone else who's going to be doing it a different way, who's going to have their own ideas and approach, and you're still, well, maybe if we use the... It's like, fuck off, mate.
I mean, it's the area where I found it hardest to disconnect and not be a fucking know-it-all. And the thing is, like, because Ben is such a, you know, such a lovely guy, you know, whereas I think maybe some other... Because the level Ben's at, the level of genius he has for his job, and the level of tolerance of me questioning his decisions, only happen because he's a very nice guy and he's very much in control of his ego.
Yeah,
I can imagine a lot of sound editors might have just been, you know what, why don't you just fuck off and do it on your own?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because I would. It was really hard with me, but the sound, like, you know, and I guess
it's finding the balance, right?
Well, I honestly don't think I found it. I think I was a bit gnarly. I was a bit nippy with that one. Right. But the thing is that slowly, bit by bit, I just realised, like, oh my God, this guy is, like, he's so clever. Because it's funny, like, you know, initially there's the scene out when they go back into the woods at night.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from, like, a sound recording kind of background, I've been out in the woods and I've done sound recording out there, and I love those thick wood sounds, and, like, it's so eerie. And so when I was writing, I was like, oh, this will be so atmospheric, this scene.
Yeah.
And then I had a meeting with Ben, and Ben was like, so for the scene, when they go back to the woods at night, I imagine it still, almost no sound from the woods at all. And I was like, oh, immediately it just felt like, why would you waste that opportunity of having that lovely thick woods at night atmosphere? Yeah. And I was like, okay, why would you do it like that? And he said, basically, well, these guys aren't scared of the woods. These guys are scared of being found out.
So
the way to, through the sound, to heap more pressure on them is to have the woods very still, and every movement of them, their body movements, the spade, every time they hit the ground, it echoes.
Yeah.
I was like, this is very clever. Do you know what I mean? That's
amazing.
You know. Yeah. So bit by bit, I realised Ben was a genius and finally shut up.
How much, in the writing process, how much does the idea of cost and funding come into the story? Because again, it seems interesting that a lot of great debut films I've seen recently are isolated in one location. Kind of isolation means, you know, a skeleton cast as such. I had Coralie Fargay on recently, who did a Revenge this year, which I absolutely adored. It blew me away. And again, is that something that influences you as a writer? And are you writing thinking, what story can I write that I will realistically be able to get made as my debut, rather than what story can I write, but then, well, this is a $100 million film, as if anyone's going to entrust me on that?
It's a bit of both, isn't it? I mean, the thing is, like, I definitely, you know, because I'd made three shorts, I knew that the with all three shorts that I made, like, the first one was about a guy, a sound recordist, who goes down into a cave. So that was one person. The second one was about a janitor on an isolated island.
Yeah.
And the third one was a woman in a house. So the third one actually, for the first time ever, had two people actually talking.
Amazing.
So I suppose I came from that, like, I knew from the start that I couldn't let the scope of Caliber kind of get out of hand, because already, even though it felt like I'd written something really contained, when it came to budgeting it, the budget was 1.5 million,
right,
which is, for a first feature, the producers did really well to get it, because normally it's a million or under.
Yeah.
And we simply couldn't have made the film for that. So even though it felt contained, then, you know, you go into pre-production and it's like, well, we've got vehicles, we've got kids, we've got ballistics, we've got special effects.
All stuff that adds up.
We've got the woods. Right? We've got the woods at night. I mean, I had a really interesting conversation with the line. I mean, again, all these roles in film that people, you know, it's all the credit just goes to, so much of the credit goes to the director. Yeah. It's like the hero on Caliber, to a large extent, was the line producer, who's the person who basically has to take the money you've got and somehow translate that,
make it work,
into making a movie that actually. And
it's a massive difference from making potentially shorts with friends and collaborators, because there's so much that you just kind of make work. Whereas when you're doing a feature that's budgeted, it's like, no, we don't make anything. Everyone has to, it has to be done the right way.
It does. And it actually took, finally, I think now, a couple of bad habits were finally beaten out of me. And one of them was like, why don't we just like grab me, Mark, the actors, and just go off and shoot it? And it's like, once you have like a crew of like 40 people, you can't do that, because it's just like, and people would say, that's not the way to do it. Like, it's a team. And if you just keep running off and trying to grab things, and it's like, you kind of have to take, like, what you get from a team of 40 people is you get the ability to create images that look like they have more production and more care and more detail.
Yeah.
You can't have your cake and eat it and then just like piss off and just shoot for half a day and just leave everyone in the middle of the woods.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of,
how was that to transition into that, to take in the awareness of the grander team, I guess, or the larger project, rather than, I'm a filmmaker, oh, let's go and make a film.
Yeah. I think it's the biggest thing with like making a film with a crew is you just have to make your peace with the fact that things take time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you can't just run around and have things just are slow, and you can either stand around going, why isn't it? Like, I remember on my second short film, we're out on this isolated island and they were trying to light this section of the island. It was like 3 in the morning, pissing down with rain. And I was just standing there going, we're running out of time, we're running out of time. And I just shouted into the dark, like, we need to shoot now. And then I heard a voice of the gaffer, who's like the lighting guy, just come back out of the darkness. And he went, we can shoot whenever you want. It'll just be black. It's your fucking movie, mate. And I was just like, I just shouted back, okay, sorry.
Yep.
You know what I
mean? Yep, you're right. It's kind of a beautiful thing though, right? Because it means when you've got a greater amount of people having their input, it means that you're going to get a better end product.
No,
you're
going
to take that more time and get a better. In the moment, and again, this is only from a music video experience where I've directed so a few of my own and worked for a long time with Tom Coles, my DOP in that. And again, there has been so much of it. If you've been going for a while, there is, oh, we need to get this. Whereas if you've not got an option, then it's like, oh, well, it'll work. Like, we'll make it work. You take them breaks off and realise that it's not the end of the world. If you don't get it in the next 5 minutes, you get it in this time. And
it
forces you to get a better result, I guess.
I think you have to sort of accept that things, let things happen a bit more slowly.
Yeah.
But when you get it well. Because if you've got 4 hours for a scene, you can just run at it like a bull in the china shop. I mean, the first AD, who's like the logistical guy, was having babies on caliber, because it's like, you know, we'd have 4 hours to shoot a certain scene and we might not shoot anything for like 2 hours and 15 minutes. And you could see him just sweating, like, what the fuck is going on? They're not shooting anything. But after that 2 hours and 15 minutes, we'd have really blocked it out carefully. The actors would know exactly what they were doing. They already would have rehearsed their performances. We've worked out all that stuff, so we know they're going to hit it right. Mark's running around, like, planning where he's going to put the camera, and we've talked all that through. And then suddenly, like, you've shot nothing after 2 hours and 15 minutes, but half an hour late, you've got loads of great shit.
You've got almost all of it.
It's kind of just trying to stay calm and not going, must shoot. Do you know, we have to shoot as quickly as possible.
So with that pressure, as I said, it must be, I think, another thing that gets overlooked. I mean, it's good that we're kind of listing all the stuff that gets overlooked in film, other than, again, the director. I've had an annoyance for ages that few people have a favourite writer. Yeah, everyone has a favourite director, and the writing.
Nobody has a favourite production designer.
No.
Nobody even knows what a production designer does.
And again, that's, as I saw Duncan Jones tweeting about this, and I did a post about it today, because Shaheen Baig, who's a casting director, had done a post about this opportunity for people to become a production designer and art designer, all that. And Duncan Jones had tweeted a few days ago saying, people see the cinema and think, I want to be an actor or I want to be a director, and they don't see all the other stuff that goes on. And his argument was, with 10, 20 years in the industry, I think the art designer and production designer may be having the best time, because they get to create worlds, and that's amazing. They get to create these worlds from nothing and go,
I mean, it's a colossal thing. I mean, again, like, it's kind of testament to Mark that he'll just throw out these sneaky little lines that are just like full of wisdom. And he said to me one time, he said, I was going to do Mark, I was trying to do a really bad Hungarian accent, which I won't do. He said in his Hungarian accent, he said, sometimes I feel that when they give out awards for cinematography, they should really give the award to the production designer.
And
you know what I mean? Essentially, a DOP can only shoot what the production designer's put in front of him. Do you know what I mean? So
that's amazing.
It's a colossal, and it is. Yeah, it's a super exciting job. I mean, that's one of the things that one of the great things about the Calibre journey was just going through each stage and realizing each stage is like super exciting. So casting was just like amazing. You know,
Let's talk about that, because the casting has been. The Scottish BAFTAs, you're up for best director and best writer, or is it best film? So that's great. But the exciting one is, as we're recording this, it's the beginning of October. The awards are in the beginning of November, I think.
Yeah.
You've won best actor because you've got all three nominations, which is insane. So all three best male actor, all three nominations from Calibre, which is...
Well, I was watching it live.
Mind-blowing, right?
Yeah, it was completely insane.
I've never even heard of that happening before, well, that they all come from the same film.
Yeah, it's funny, actually, because I was like, you're always, when that kind of thing happens, you're always looking for, like, yeah, can we say this is the first time ever, and that actually looked, and it happened last year with Trainspotting 2.
Oh, wow.
But the thing is, that's fucking Trainspotting 2.
That's Trainspotting 2, mate. Yeah. That's kind of...
But it was surreal when it got read out, because I was listening to it live, and it was just like, Jack Loudon, Calibre. Yeah. Martin McCann, Calibre. I thought we've got two. Tony Curran, Calibre. I was like, we're going to win every award.
Yeah.
Which, you know.
That's amazing.
It's
that right?
It's great. And I mean, but that's sort of down to, you know, each stage of film, making a film is like a massive collaboration between the director and someone. And, you know, we had an amazing casting director. Because, again, I don't know if people think... You know, it's just like, oh, the director picked loads of great people, didn't he? It's like, no, the director was talking to Theo Park, who kept sending him lists of...
It was amazing, and, has, you know, really came under Nina Gold and people like that, so it's amazing stuff. Just, and worked with Simon Pegg and all that for years, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And because I was like, honestly, I was like, at the beginning, I was like, are there really enough great Scottish actors there to cast this all Scottish, or do we have to cheat and get some English actors to do it? And then she starts sending me these lists of, like, you know, Cal McInnish, who plays Al McClay, who is actually a pivot. He's the guy who's basically always staring at them and always seems to have a read on them.
Yeah.
Like, amazing fucking actor that I'd never heard of. Do you know what I mean? And
it's stunning. It's a fascinating a world because, again, it's absolutely key.
Mm.
That's absolutely key because as a writer... Again, you'll probably have certain scripts you're working on that you're writing a character thinking, well, ideally,
here's who
I'd go for. And that becomes unrealistic or until. But then they present someone who is more right for that role than who you had in your head, if you know what I mean. It's like, how have you found this character out there?
For sure. I think the big takeaway for casting for me was, like, don't cast on preconceptions you have of the character's physical.
Great.
Physicality. So initially, the Marcus character, I was like, it seemed really important to me that Marcus was taller than Vaughan because he kind of dominates him. And also that he was probably, I thought he was probably English upper class, very chiseled, for like a real pretty boy.
Yeah.
And now Martin, obviously, Jack's taller than Martin. Martin's not English, he's Irish.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So, like, when that came to the table, I was like, but Jack Loudon's going to be like physically dominating this guy.
Yeah.
And he's Irish, and how's that fit? And but then Martin's casting tape came in, and it was just literally my entire conception of the Marcus character just sort of dissolved and reformed around Martin. Because the thing is, he was like, his casting tape was just insane. It was like, he's actually, the character's alive. Do you know what I mean? It was like, that is Marcus. And it literally happened within 10 minutes.
I love that. And that's a sign of a really good casting director as well, because they're not going for what was on paper, what you were looking for. It's one of the things I felt really lucky in a few of the casting directors I've really hit it off with, because more often than not, I mean, I'm 6'4" and I've got a big beard and quite a striking, so more often than not, I'm not what was on paper. They have that faith or that belief or that excitement in, let's see what you can do. Let's send this over as an option.
Yeah.
Because it's exciting to go, right, actually, maybe we can go somewhere else. I was moaning about it online the other day that, again, being a big comic book nerd and film fan, it infuriates me that whenever there's a new project announced, people get angry over the casting of it before it's even happened. It's like, they want cosplayers. They don't want actors. I want actors. I want to see their performance and their interpretation of that character. And then I'll get angry if it's shit. I'll get excited if it's good. But not when I say, here's who's playing them. It's like, well, he doesn't look exactly like that drawing from 30 years ago. It's like, well, why would he look like that? That's not the be-all and end-all. And it's exciting to know that, or to have that outlook of, look, here's what I had in mind.
Yeah.
But let's see what comes about. Let's see if something, if nothing blows that out of the water, then perfect.
Yeah,
that's what I had in mind. Or we'll find that. But if not...
But it's kind of... All the acting thing is really about is somebody, like, being inside the character. You know, I mean, we saw about 20 people for Marcus, but it was like what Martin was doing was just a completely... it was just something completely different. You know what I mean? He was actually, it was like, he's alive. You know what I mean? He's not alive as him. This character is suddenly alive. Do you know what I mean? It was eerie.
Yeah.
And it was eerie because he was so different, but suddenly it was like, it was, there was no fucking question. It was like, that is it.
Do you think there's an importance, and it's tough because the bigger you get as a director or writer, the bigger the names of cast you're likely to get. But do you think there's an art and importance in presenting characters played by actors that you don't necessarily already know beforehand? It occurred to me that things like Game of Thrones, as an example, one of the reasons that was so amazing is because we didn't know any of those people. Mm. For half of the people in it, it was genuinely their first ever gig. I had John Bradley on, and he was kind of saying he's terrified of it ending because his first ever role was in Game of Thrones. Now he has to go out and get other roles, and he's the dude from Game of Thrones, so that's a big... And guys, I've had a lot of guys from Shane Meadows films on, and they've all struggled with that at points, is they have their breakthrough role in a Shane Meadows film, and then they're going in at a certain level that they might not be comfortable with because the way Shane directs is so different from a lot of directors and stuff like that. So,
well, that's exactly what I was going to say. I think, like, being on the Shane Meadows, from what I can gather, being on the Shane Meadows set is quite significantly different to being on other sets.
Yeah, or Andrew Shim, when I had him on, he was saying how hard it was to go on from A Room for Romeo Brass, which blew me away, and This Is England, because they workshop stuff and they do this and then they go out there. They don't kind of have and then he got a role after that and it was like, here's your lines, learn them. And he was like, what? I'm not used to that, which is mind blowing for someone who, again, I've seen his performances and been like, he's amazing. So those weird,
You know, I don't know if this is the right time to say it, but you know, one of the things that really like shocked me a bit on Calibre was almost the opposite of that, which is, you know, I worked with Jack and Martin for about 10 days straight.
Yeah.
And we were just, it was very, just the us, like, doing these scenes with them together. And then on about day 10, suddenly there were 14 actors. And the thing is, when actors get together, they start having fun.
Yeah.
You know, and they start basically arsing about.
Yeah.
So basically they were arsing about and it was, yeah, everything was fine. But then this one day I was like, we were setting up for like a shot and they were just all talking and you could hear all these conversations going on everywhere. And I was like, right, after this take, I'm going to the first AD and I'm going to go, we need to put a stop to this basically. And then they were literally talking and I could see we're about to shoot and they're all talking. And then the first AD said, right, okay, in action. And they just all just in an instant, just dropped back into character and did a perfect take. And I was like, that's crazy. Do you know what I mean? Because it's like, I suppose that's the flip side of the, like, with Shane Meadows, you would workshop and everyone would dissolve into these characters. Into
it, yeah.
But really good actors,
yeah,
weirdly, can literally, you know what I mean? They can be like looking at a YouTube video and then just turn the phone off and do it.
And go, here we are.
Let's go. If they can do it and it's completely believable, then there's, you know, you can't
it's
argue.
It's valid,
isn't it?
Exactly. It's the argument against method. It's like, oh, you do that. Oh, no, I'd turn up and I act.
Yeah.
It's kind of the old... it's like, oh yeah, I get that.
But I mean, the thing is interesting about, you know, known faces, and it's very difficult because obviously, you know, you make Calibre, and we were very lucky in the sense that, like, you know, Martin's been around for a while, and he's a great actor, but he's just sort of still, he feels like a fresh face, and Jack's, you know, sort of at the beginning of his trajectory enough that he seems like a fresh face. And that's ideal because there is a sense where if you have people who you don't know their faces, you just buy into them as people as much more intensely. But then if you write a script and the script's set in America, then it just begs the question. It's like, you know, if Christian Bale comes back and says, I love it.
Yeah.
You know, there was an interesting thing actually recently, you know, that movie Mandy that looks completely fucking mental. But
I auditioned for it.
Oh, really?
It was amazing, yeah. It was one of the most funs I've had on doing a self-tape because it was just huge.
Yeah.
You could just play it huge and just be completely, here's what it is.
Yeah.
Let's see how that goes.
But recently I saw an interview with, it was like some interview at Sundance with, where it had the director and then it had Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
And the director said, you know, someone had told me like Nicolas Cage really likes Beyond the Black Rainbow or whatever
his first
movie, I think that's what it's called, and he really likes it and he's really interested in this role, And he was like, oh, well, it's great that Nicolas Cage is like into this, but the thing is that this role's for a guy who's like 25.
Yeah.
So would he be interested in this role? And so word came back and was like, Nick Cage is interested in this role, as previously stated.
Yeah.
And he said, so I basically thought, you know, well, that's not going to work because, you know, it's not right for that part. And he said, and then about a week later, I woke up one morning and went, what the fuck am I doing?
Yeah.
Like, Nicolas Cage wants to be in my movie. The answer is yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And the thing is, that's the thing you're in. It's like, you know, would you, if you know, if you wrote a script and then it's like, well, you know, Ryan Gosling and Christian Bale are really interested in these roles. Yeah. And it's quite a big call to go, no, I want fresh faces.
Yeah completely.
But it's a huge, you know. Yeah. Also, it's a budget thing. You simply wouldn't get the same budget.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, again, I think it's great that we've got a lot of actors now. And again, it's unfair because he's kind of a pal, but I was a fan of him before I worked with him. You've got people like Tom Hardy and Christian Bale and people like that who are going out and transforming. They're not just going out and being, here I am, I'm that famous actor. They are transforming. They are losing themselves in it. So it isn't as much of that risk of like, oh, we mentioned Pacino earlier. I adore Pacino, but Pacino is generally, like, you cast Pacino because you want Pacino
to come
in and be Pacino. Whereas you've got a lot of these huge actors now who do have that. They can be, you're not just getting them as the name, you're getting them as the artist.
I mean, it's a bit of a minefield because sometimes the transformation can become distracting.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like in Black Mass, like Johnny Depp, like it's a great performance, but it's almost like they went too far with the transformation. So it's like, why does he have those weird eyes?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
take the fucking eyes out and let him just act.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But
yeah, I think it's not realizing that the excitement of Johnny Depp not playing the Captain Jack Sparrow / Willy Wonka / the Mad Hatter, or you know, that's enough. That's the transformation in itself.
Exactly.
It doesn't have to be as well. Here's all this other stuff we're doing.
Yeah. But I think it's tricky, you know, because I think ultimately all you can really do is you would want to work with really great actors, and you just have to try and separate the ones who you think are the ones who are really acting and the ones who are just have a charisma and a personality, because I think there is a separation.
Again, they're both fine. Like there's a place for both of them, but from your side of it, you're going to be looking at the ones that it's like, right, here's.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at like a movie like The Big Short, you know what I mean? Like that's some very well-known actors, but they've done a really good job of making you forget that you're watching like Brad Pitt. You forget that you're watching like Steve Carell. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, completely.
You don't really forget you're watching Ryan Gosling because he's Ryan Gosling, but you know what I mean?
You forget.
But they
almost had him on the podcast recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had it lined up. But I'm a big fan of Gosling.
Yeah, me too.
But they could only give me 20 minutes and kind of... The point of the podcast is that it's these longer conversations.
Well, ours is going to be, what, 3-4 hours?
Yeah.
We're only just kicking up.
Exactly. But it was one of them. It was like the hardest thing I've done. I was like, I'd love to.
You're not tempted to get him in and just see whether, like, mind you, it doesn't work like that. It's not like he could... Gosling might have just put his hand up to the window and gone.
Oh, that's it. On that one, because it was such... He was only over for one day. There was a ton of press. It was like, right, this isn't going to... I'm not... You know, if I overrun slightly, it's fucking ruining his day.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? It's making it worse. So it was one of them where it was like, I'd rather hold out. Because, again, I had that with... A Fassbender was one of the first ones that they gave me 45 minutes... And on that day, like the people after me it was a 15-minute slot and it was for 8 journalists all to ask questions. So they'd gone above and beyond and it worked.
And
it was Michael's favourite interview of that run and all this kind of thing. So it's made me realise, right, if the opportunity comes, it will come. And I'd rather have Ryan Gosling in 2 films' time and actually have the amount of time to chat to him and just be in the same room as his beautiful presence.
It's a big call. I mean, how weird is it when you get, like, somebody, like... Is it Marc Maron, that guy?
Yeah.
Like, there was one where I was sort of looking up his podcast and suddenly, like, he had Barack Obama.
Yeah.
You know that one where they like his whole, because he's just in his garage.
Yeah, 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 in his garage.
But they'd had to shut down the whole street and they had snipers on all of the tops. But like, how is it weird when you get somebody that fucking famous in and they're sitting opposite you? Do you get used to that?
Again, I think the thing that is the love and hate people have with my podcast is I only have people on that I'm genuinely excited to talk to. Mm-hmm. So with Fassbender, like, I'm a massive fan of his work. And I had one person who was like, you didn't ask him, I would have rather heard about like him on a night out and stuff like that. I'm like, yeah, but I've got 45 minutes with him. I want to talk to him about shame and about all these things. And really just, and hopefully that clicks. And again, in that one, it worked. Just instantly my ridiculous enthusiasm of like, and also on this film, and that kind of lends itself mm-hmm. to that. And he shared that excitement. So it kind of, it worked. But yeah, I don't know. I think, as we were discussing before, and Spike Lee was one of the first ones that I was a bit nervous because he's huge. And also, he was one of the first big names I had that I felt slightly unqualified.
Mm.
Like, I like Spike Lee, but I've not watched all of his stuff. And I felt, again, on that one, like, three people, I think, were getting to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of them. So it's like, I feel some pressure there. Oh, an example, actually, I've not told anyone this. I just turned down the opportunity to have Mike Lee on. And Mike Lee is an absolute legend, and mm-hmm. I'm aware, but I'm not enough of an expert on him to do that justice. Yeah. It was a really hard one. I went back and forth with the plugger person saying, look, if I had time to knuckle down, because Mike Lee is someone who
You'd need to go on like a Mike. You'd need to do like a sort of all night Mike Lee.
Absolute binge. But he's someone who I've had on my list for years that I need to get. I've never got into him. I need to get into him more.
Yeah, I'm
aware. People I respect frequently reference him and talk about him and all that. But the fact is, the podcast came up and it was like, he's available in a week or so. And I'm like, look, I feel I would annoy his fans because I'd be there having boned up in a week and trying my best to kind of to make it work. And yeah, so that's it. It makes it interesting because it means I know that if I turn guests down, it's not because they're shit or because I don't rate them or respect them. I go completely off of if I think I'm capable of getting a good conversation with them. And if I'm not, then it is what it is.
I mean, I suppose the thing is, like, sometimes you meet, you know, you meet people, and this happened with Danny Houston about a decade ago at Edinburgh Film Festival. And sometimes when people are those kind of, they're that charismatic.
Yeah.
It's just weird. Like, they have, like, this crazy, I mean, I'm not, like, really into that kind of stuff, so I don't know how to put it into any kind of rational context, but the aura of the motherfuckers is just the aura of Danny Houston. It was just like, it was like he was glowing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I've had that once with like an actress who were cast, and I was just like sort of sat in front of her, just sort of going like there were like some really embarrassing silences for about 10 seconds because I was just like gobsmacked by like, who are you? Like, what?
This is, I've had that a few times. And the tough thing now as well on the podcast front is, number one, thinking if I'm the right person to get a good interview with them. And number two, thinking, do I want to pass up the opportunity to meet them? Because again, I'm sure people will hear it all the time on the podcast, but a lot of the people I have on, people I hope to work with sometime down the line. Mm. So it's one of them. It's like, if we're going to have a 45-minute conversation and link, it's at least me getting the chance to go, you know that film reference? I get it. You know, I know this stuff, and we can enjoy each other's company, you know, kind of thing. So that's kind of a tough one because it's like, right, there's someone I respect. But again, it's trying to keep true to the kind of the point of the podcast. That it's the whole point has been that it's not based on fame. I'll have some huge people on, but that's not the be all and end all. They're long form interviews. It's not about sound bites or here's my new film. That's all. Ironically, all we've talked about really is Caliber, but it's a debut film. That makes sense in this way. But and trying to stick to those ethics on it rather than just going, well, I'm being offered a big name and I'll get a lot of downloads and helps sponsorship and all that kind of thing. But yeah, it's interesting. But we're at like an hour and 15,
so
we should have to wrap things up now.
Okay.
I'll kind of end it with asking, what is the plan and aim going forward? Because it's an exciting time in blockbusters as well, because a lot of blockbusters, a lot of big studios are giving relatively new directors the keys to big projects. So you've seen with things like Skull Island, Kong, that was Jordan on that. It made like one or two films. And then there's this, and a lot of the superhero things and things like that are going, rather than sticking to the tried and tested, we're going to reinvigorate these things by going, here's a new person. And yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty cautious about that. I mean, my agent said, like, you know, sometimes these kind of... I'm not entirely sure. Caliber's maybe a bit too serious-minded for, like, me to be lined up for any kind of...
But it's getting that excitement and hype, and that's, again, I think that's something that people particularly from a producer point of view get excited about, is looking and going, well, with the greatest respect... This film has no right to be where it is. This should be a great film that never really saw the light of day, as so many small films are, that never really get that bigger platform. But because of the timing on Netflix and this and that, it seems to have had this, like, here's its moment.
But I honestly mean, that is amazing. And it's, the what's happened with Caliber has been just a kind of dream come true. But I do think that if you jump into a sort of studio project that's like 100 million, essentially you
I don't know how to spend 100 million.
Well, the thing is, you literally have no control. Do you know what I mean? And the thing is, I don't think it's not a move I would make, because the thing is that there's some great companies out there, like, you know, there's a lot of new companies like Annapurna and A24 who will fund more serious mind, and like Foxcatcher, like how the fuck did Foxcatcher get made on like something like 24 million?
Such a
kind of strange, interesting,
dark
movie. But that's kind of, to me, that's the kind of that would be, if I could do that, that'd be amazing and much more exciting to me than, you know, because I said at the beginning, I don't want to stand in a garage with a great big blue screen and watch people running around in suits,
like those
suits with the things on. It's just not my. I want to be out in the woods. I want to be visiting, like, Rust Belt cities in America and seeing places and places that have some actual texture. Do you know what I mean? So
a Wild Bunch are one of them companies that just blow me away with what they seem to do to get these amazing budgets for such bizarre projects. Yeah, they're ones that. Yeah. As soon as, like, there's a feature film I've written, the TV stuff I've written, far easier to get a bit of interest because it's TV at the moment. But there's the one feature I've written that's getting no interest whatsoever. I keep saying to my guys, like, if we can get anyone at Wild Bunch to look at it, because they're the kind of people who go, right, it's a bit mental.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a surefire thing, but
there's
something there. We can make this work. Just having seen some of the mad stuff that they put a lot of money into, and
and I think when that's
amazing art.
I think when those kind of companies do fund, like, directors haven't done so much, they are literally, whereas the Hollywood studios, they'd be kind of cool to do something with them. They really, what they mean is, let's get them in and then
secure in a future
and
relationship
then, and then mince them.
So I'm
kind of cautious about that. But to be honest, the main thing, and it has been from the start, is if I get to make another movie, that's great.
Yeah.
Because that's ultimately all that really matters.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to seeing what's next.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Picks Distraction Pieces.
There we go. There's your bonus for the week. If you listen to this on the Friday, I hope I see you tomorrow, because tomorrow is the last We Are Lizards Club night of the year. I will be at the book club from 8 p.m. till 3 a.m. Come and enjoy the evening with me. There will be drinking. There will be dancing. There will be loud music. There will be rubber lizard masks. Come and get involved. All the usual stuff. Patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. I'd love you to join our little secret gang. I'd kind of love you to. The reason I like Patreon more than other social medias is it's so refined. Like, there's only a few hundred of us over there, whereas there's tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands on the other socials. Kind of a big deal. So it's cool that over there I can read every response, interact with everyone. It's this refined, hardcore team.
So, yeah, come and join us. Or head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and grab some merch. Do what you do. I shall talk to you all soon, and I will see you next week, because I'm joined by David Lowry, one of my favourite writers and directors, and a podcast that I was super nervous about, because I've not met the dude. I was recording 6 podcasts in a week that week, and I kind of half knew everyone else I was having on except for David. I knew his work, but I didn't know him. And then we just hit it off. It was just the most natural and flowing conversation. So I loved it. I can't wait for you to all hear that. Anyway, I'll be back next week. Until then, have fun. And don't do anything. Treat people do your best to be try and live in the until then, I'll be back next week. Until then, aim to achieve that. I'll be back next week with more distraction pieces. Until then, until then, try if the world gives you basically what you want to see in if you look out into the into the world, then if at first you don't know, just try not to live how social media tries to tell you it's acceptable to live. All right, bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.